the question.
Okay.
That's great. That's cool.
All right. So, yeah, he's a feature available on most of the modern Intel CPUs, which is, stands for physical address exchange, which allows technically to run machines with up to 64 gigabytes of memory. So recently, as part of my work, I had to implement it for OpenBSD, and it actually been committed. So I made a little presentation about what's it all about and how we can use it, and just sometimes people often have wrong ideas about what it is. Why is it needed in the first place? Of course, increased memory demand for on faster machines, because running a lot of large memory consuming processes would of course eventually lead to a lot of paging, because we only have 3.5 basically gigabytes of physical memory normally on the Intel box. So if you run, say, 4 processes, each one of them 1 gigabyte virtual space, we end up paging because there is just not enough physical memory. And we lose all the benefit that we get from actually fast, having especially SMP fast machines. And of course, PAE has one of the security benefits. On some CPUs, it supports extra permission bit on the page tables, which allows non-execution permission for the page tables, as it's done on most of the same RISC CPUs, where currently non-exec support where that prevents data or stack to be executed, which is one of the basic concepts for a WSORX mechanism we have for security. It's implemented based on the segmentation, which is has some implications on the security anyway. And of course, it's a very useful feature is running 32-bit i386 port on the AD64 machines, where lots of people run all kinds of strange Linux binaries, which they have to run for whatever their purpose is in the company. So what it is, basically it's the same page tables as normal i386 has, except instead of 32 bits they have 64 bits. Well, quite similar to what we have on AMD64, except on AMD64 we have, I think, 52 bits physical address, and here we have only 36 bits, which is 64 gigabytes. And because it's very similar in functionality and data organization to the old page tables, it can reuse source from the existing code just by changing few types and couple of divs. And of course, it's not something that has never been done before. Linux has it and FreeBSD has it. The only major difference is that you have to compile a special kernel which supports it, and that kernel will only support PAE, or it will support all page tables. And because PAE basically causes serious performance loss due to the larger data being moved around, it's not feasible to run PAE kernel on the machine if you don't have enough physical memory where you actually need it. So this is more or less organization the normal i386 PMAT. It's snapshot little piece from the comments in the TMAT.c file, and it has much more, so it's quite useful documentation if you don't feel like reading into manual. So basically, this is how the 32-bit virtual address is parsed. So there is a control register 3 that points to one page, which is called page directory, which has 1024 entries, 4 bytes each, 32 bits each, that each one of them is a physical pointer to an actual page table that contains the mapping, the permissions, and the part of and the 20 bits of physical address for the translation. So combining those 20 bits with 12 bits from the virtual address, which is page offset, we get the full 32-bit physical address. Plus, page table entry contains 12 bits of permission, such as is the writing allowed into the page, is this page has been accessed or has it been written into, or and other stuff that operating system uses and CPU uses, which is not related to addressing directly. So for PAE, the difference is not very large, because every entry instead of 32 bits, it becomes 64 bits. It's obvious that there has to be another layer of indirection to address the data. So, because every page can only contain now 512 entries, half that it would before. So there are same structure from here down, except before there's added four pointers, 464-bit pointers, physical pointers to four of those page directory pages. So basically here you immediately can see the performance impact. Because before, for the CPU to translate virtual address into physical, it needs only two memory reads. Now it needs three memory reads. Of course, that information is cached in the CPU, but the caches are not infinite and they flush on every context switch. So here's immediately performance hit that we would have. But on the other hand, you can see it's very similar structure to what we have in the 32 bits. So basically, we can reuse most of the code that we have already by changing the types. And so PMAP is similar, but on the same hand is completely different. So 18 functions in the PMAP module become function pointers because they are different for two different implementations, for 32-bit PMAP and 64-bit PMAP. So that's another performance hit, although it's not really noticeable on modern, say, 1 gigahertz and higher machines. And the page directory used to be 4 kilobytes, now it's 16 kilobytes, which also pushes more pressure onto the kernel virtual memory, because before we only need one page, now we need four continuous pages, which is due to memory fragmentation could be much harder to allocate in case we're running a lot of processes in this using this version of PMAP. And of course the register that points to the whole page table, it used to be by design 20 bits, now it's 27, which actually I'm not sure if Intel describes it. Well, they don't have it in the manual. Maybe they meant it to be. But this actually allows us to transit from the 32-bit PMAP into 64 while kernel is fully loaded and running. Not in the single user, but right before single user, you can make a decision. Do we want to run 64-bit or 32-bit physical addresses? Virtual space stays all the same. It's not like process gating anymore. So how this whole thing basically impacts the kernel? PRRT is a kernel type used to represent a physical address. So it becomes 64 bits, which means all the math, address math that used to be 32 bits becomes 64 bits, which is more code and more CPU power. So that's performance hit a little bit. And kernel virtual address space consumption also grows because page tables are larger and the physical addresses are larger, which means some of the kernel structures are larger. And we only have about half a gigabyte of kernel virtual space, which is used to allocate everything, MBOX for networking or memory, MBOX clusters, or buffer cache structures, or file systems internal structures for the kernel. So this is one of the impacts which is I have not quite evaluated yet, but it's supposed to be future work. Plus address type is the address that is used to represent the address for devices to do DMA on or access registers on the bus. It's not expanded, it's still 32-bit, which actually currently is all right because most of the hardware in the system cannot support 64-bit operation. even on the machines that are shipped with large memory and CPUs that support large memory. And the, there is probably one or two chipsets that can reliably do it anyway. And the, as I mentioned before, some of the function calls for the PMAP module are made through pointers, which of course hits the performance a little bit too. And PCI DMAs still stays 32 bits. This means that any time that the network packet is received or has to be sent or the data has to be read or read from the drive, we can only give the device 32-bit physical address. If we have to perform an operation on 64-bit, some of the memory that is about 4 gigabytes, we have to do basically copy. You have to allocate the bounce buffer below 4 gigabytes, do an operation on it, then copy in the upper memory, which is a huge performance hit. Although, well, in this work, there are several ways to improve the situation, one of which is OpenBSD doesn't have unified buffer cache, which means buffer cache is allocated during the kernel boost, which means it's always below 4 gigabytes. So for Giskayo, we never have a problem with copy data error. And for networking and most of other viable structures, we can enforce, we can prioritize allocation of those from below 4 gigabytes by using certain kernel APIs, in which case we practically never need, we never need to copy data around. And for everything else, we try and allocate memory from above 4 gigabytes. What is the right thing to do it, and which is actually the reason why we haven't had it for a while, the way it's done in Linux and FreeBSD, and what actually makes this work seriously different from those efforts is all the code is always in the same generic kernel. You don't need any other kernel. You have generic, and you enable it, and you, there are a couple of ways to enable it right now because it's not quite production use yet. So the choice to which way to go, do we want to run with the full 36 support, bit support, or 32 bit support, is made when the kernel is already running, but already probed the devices. So basically, based on the information, what kind of devices we have in the system, do they support 64-bit DMA? Do our PCI bus switches support 64-bit DMA? Do we actually have drivers for all that crap? Then we can say, okay, we can efficiently run, can run the system, we can switch over to the new page tables and support all our, whatever, 16 or 40, so 6 gigs of memory. And of course, a huge effort is put into making sure that the copy is the very, very last resort. And they actually only a few not very heavy testing I ran never had a problem with, actually never had copying happen, although I never caused the system to swap, which is another reason to support large memory, is to avoid swapping completely. Because if you have 16 gig of memory, we can more or less plan our system in such a way that we don't need swap anymore. Maybe for core dumps, but then in production we probably don't even need core dumps. Who's going to look at them anyway? And the, what is the future work? A lot has to be done on conserving kernel virtual space, because it is very well known and very well spread fork bombing in Unix box. You run enough, you fork enough processes are consuming enough of virtual memory, which is backed up by physical memory and swap anyway, and eventually your kernel panic anyway. So we're using, by allowing to use 64 gig of memory, we use much more kernel virtual space, which means we have to put some effort into reduce the consume of the, by the kernel of its memory. And the very useful utility of this work would be to use the non-execution protection, which is available on some CPUs, on most of AMD CPUs, and quite a few Intel, especially Xeon CPUs, which should be easy to support, actually. And there is, of course, a lot of constraints in the kernel with the very large physical memory. For example, the largest I tested so far is 16 gigabytes, and there are issues with it already. Kernel running out of all kinds of resources that are statically allocated, kernel over-allocating virtual space and for itself. And the part of that work has actually happened in NetBSD, but for completely different reasons. They don't support PAE at all. But apparently they already fixed a number of issues in UVM. And the one of the probably very serious piece of work which could be done later is to support 64-bit PCI DMA, in which case we don't care really where the DMA is happening. We don't really have to make any efforts into allocating particular physical pages for kernel data and stuff. And but this actually, the hard part about it is that lots of PCI host bridges on the machines do not even support it. And those that support it have huge bugs in them. So basically, DMA is very unreliable. So identifying systems that would work and writing support for them, that would probably be not a lot of code, but it would be a huge effort to actually do it reliably. And another work that could quite well be done, and I think Linux has it, but probably the wrong way, as usual, is to support full 4 gigabytes for kernel virtual space, in which case we get rid of all kinds of problems with the kernel virtual space, because 4 gigabytes is more or less enough for everybody. And user gets a little bit more, because currently user has less than 3 gigabytes of virtual space, and actually only 1 gigabyte of data space. And we can expand that, allowing user processes to be even larger. And well, here I would like to say the company where I work in Genoa, that they actually supported and the whole work, and they, of course, Cindy and Munchen and Augustine Brewery for fueling the right thinking. And a lot of people help testing and providing feedback, and that's the whole reason why it finally made an OpenBSD current, because it's quite a huge change and requires a lot of support from the user community. And we always have to remind the people to support OpenBSD, because that's how OpenBSD works, by donations from people or companies using it, or people submitting actual code in the best case. And developers are people still doing a donation.
Before we move on, there's actually just some additional seats that people want to squeeze in on the sides. You guys want to?
I didn't want to put a lot of technical stuff because PMAP is very hardcore thing, and if it's not for beer, I would never have done it.
Does anybody have any questions?
Mike, can you talk much about the comparison between this and other PAE implementations
in the 80s? Yeah. I can tell you what it is. How did you go about pushing the kernel for the attack? Yeah, that's actually a funky job. One part is the type that changed the physical address type. It's almost everywhere in the kernel it's used with all kinds of arithmetics, mixed with the long integer and stuff. So there it's very easy to figure out, because GCC finds the mixed operation between 64 and 32 bit where you lose precision. Compile and you more or less find it. There was a number of issues that did not show up properly. The main problem would be printf formats, such as printing amount of available memory, which is printed as percent LX, which is 32-bit X, or percent LD, LU, as a 32-bit and signed number. And in this case, it becomes 64, so it passed the mistake as two 32-bit numbers. So the numbers that are printed are really funny. That was easy to find. There were a few other ones, but one way to do it is to enable GCC warnings about the incompatibility between formats and the types of the values that are passed to printf. And the, of course, there is 5 billion false positives, but otherwise you find some useful. That's why we have it disabled for the kernel anyway, in the first place. Not very useful. But there was not so many of them. There was a few drivers that have misused the types, and not that many. UVM was pretty much clean. There was one serious issue where UVM calculates, it has to allocate one structure for each physical page, in which case it takes a whole number of physical pages multiplied by the structure size, and somewhere in there overflows the 32-bit. So there it needed to cut because, well, that was easy to find too because the kernel crashes without even printing it.
Other questions, comments?
You mentioned using the generic kernel.
Yep.
OpenBSD still isn't dynamically sized itself to a lot of parameters like soft limits on memory and file descriptors and that sort of stuff.
Oh, file descriptor is actually controllable by CCTL. If you want more, you can add more. It's just some sort of limit which is based on the max user, which is some magic number. You can make it 556, but then you kind of overlocate your lower limits. So if you have a desktop, your defaults are usually all right. If you want to run, I don't know, 500 Apaches, each one of them 500 virtual hosts, then of course you have to raise the file descriptors and a whole bunch of other numbers, but they're raisable. Number of processes is a CCTL. You can change it during the boot. It's a completely dynamic stuff. Well, of course, I mentioned you. Number of MBUFs is completely dynamic. It's not statically allocated at all. MBUF cluster has some particular limit which you can dynamically change during the boot with CCTL. Normal limit is 8,000 clusters, which is 16 megabytes of memory basically. And unless you're using several gigabit Ethernet, that usually is all right. Of course, I mentioned before that the very large memory is not very well supported currently because exactly for this reason, UVM has a number of data structures that are currently statically pre-allocated based on the physical memory size and slope size and all kinds of other numbers, which doesn't make any sense, especially using slope size for this. Because if you ever would have slope size and use PAE, the slope size would be the size of your physical memory to contain the crash time. Because otherwise you don't need a slope. The whole point is you have a lot of memory, you run everything in the memory. And for that reason, I actually have the GIF. I haven't done much testing with it, so it's in the works. It's not that hard. There are not so many things that really are currently a big problem.
Other questions, comments? okay, as I mentioned, before we continue, one of the things that we did last year that actually played a very, very nice role for the BSDs and something I think ideally would be great if user groups actually played this role was raising money last year, the OpenBSD Hackathon. I mean, if people see the discussions that go on, how the fundraising takes place with all the BSDs individually, it's, you know, well, all the vendors use our stuff, and our license allows them to use it, but they never actually give back. But one of the nice things, I think, the role that a nice bug could play in other user groups like Nicebug is actually concretely just raise money for the BSDs. What we did last year, as I mentioned earlier, we raised $600 last year, member donations. Basically, we passed around a bucket. So that's one thing we're going to do. We're going to pass around a pitcher. So we want to encourage people to go. I know Ray is going to the hackathon. Is anybody else going to the hackathon this year? Mickey's on. Anybody else going to hackathon? Anyway, Ray's going to be our envoy from Nice Bug delivering money this year. But additionally, the other thing we're going to do that we're going to have at the end of the meeting is that we have a whole lot of t-shirts that Mickey's donated. OpenBSD t-shirts. There's one with Arms of the Gills with the blowfish. Another one is So Long and Thanks for All the Passwords, which apparently is Hitchhiker's Guide. I've never read that. But so anyway, we're going to be selling those for $7 a piece. And if you get more than one, we'll do $6. There's really funky sizes. So, you know, there's like, I think we only have these in triple extra large. I can wear a subway. But anyway, so we're going to be selling that. So I'm going to start it off, and I'm just going to start passing around a bucket. So we definitely want to encourage people to contribute. It sounds kind of stupid because, like, you know, if you watch the list, you watch the fundraising. Most of it's done virtually. But I think that, like, donating, especially with the user group, you know, actually gives us a lot more credibility in the face of the community that it's not, like, you know, one of those, like, stupid hobbyist user group type things that are around, but actually people who are concretely supporting development. Anyway, so I'm going to start passing around. And, and then I guess, let's see, was there anything else? Let's see. And one more, thank you to Suspenders for hosting us back here. So that's very cool. Then everybody happy so far?
Nobody likes the Apple Store? We can hear the speaker.
I know, you hear the speaker.
And we can eat.
And we can eat and drink. Ray, you said enough, thanks. Cut them off.
We didn't thank the speaker.
Sorry?
We didn't thank the speaker.
Okay, let's thank the speaker. I didn't think of that one. Thank you, Ray. Okay. Next up is Misha, who also worked at the same firm, which I can't pronounce. But anyway, Misha's going to be speaking for a bit longer, I think, and he's going to, I guess, hopefully going a bit more into the concretes of the implementation that they're doing at their firm for clients. So, anyway, do you want questions during? Do you want an answer? How do you want to do it?
I want as much questions during the talk as possible. I want to have this as much interactive as possible, so we have the board, we can make up any scenario you figure out. We want to do that at our site, and we're interested in this. What's your suspension? We can figure something out. Actually, I have just a bunch of scenarios we're using and how we implement stuff for VPN with OpenBSD. And so whenever you have questions, additions, corrections, whatever, just feel free to call in. Sorry. Well, my name is Misha Beam. I work for Gainwise, a company that's called like the city in Italy. Nothing to do with new at all. And well, we're doing basically firewall solutions and VPN solutions on OpenBSD. We do the whole development, and I'm doing the deployment for large corporation customer hub. So this will be a little more high level than the stuff Mickey was talking about. Since he's in the development group, that's all right, I guess. So, well, as I already said, you already had a talk on the implementation of IPsec, I guess. And so this will be a bunch of scenarios what we talk about. All right, we have this scenario, we have this setup, we bought this customer, we whatever the company figure out to do next, and they're coming to you and they say, all right, you need to secure this, you need to secure that, we have this and that. So we'll look into IPsec for interconnecting networks. Well, the most basic thing you could actually do is just the normal interconnecting networks, but we'll see how it works with the bridging and just family interconnecting and how you can secure and move over to another another level of security. And then we'll look at SSH, which is totally flexible and has many different ways we're using it for. Well, actually, Marcus Spieler works for us, so he's kind of an SSH guy. That makes us do a lot of that stuff. And actually really useful stuff. Well, there's been a lot of scenarios. We look at SSH gateway, where we can use for administrative use all our external logins from home. We come over SSH. We look at some rendezvous technique, which is actually more and more companies have they have all kinds of machines, whatever, that, and they don't want to bring in the people to like physically go there and work on it. They want to have remote login. For example, for printing machines, huge printing devices, they just want to have data collecting all the time. And then if something goes wrong, login, have some VNC, whatever connection there, mostly Windows-based, and there we use this rendezvous technique where you can bring in some people from outside. We'll have this on the board. And then we have a SSH launch daemon. It's a daemon we have especially for ad hoc networks where you just have you have dial-up connections and you at some point just want to hook up a secure channel over the network, over the internet, and deliver some data. So we'll come to that too. Well, what's IPsec all about? I guess you all know about IPsec. It's just not to remember you what it's all about. The pseudo protocol. It's got all, well, it's layer 3 protocols too. It's got authentication header, which basically only gives you authentication, encapsulating security payload, which is what we're going to be using later on. It has compression, so what we also have is like you deliver huge if uncompressed images, and what we want to do is somehow compress that. We have it for IPsec, also for SSH. You can do online compression of the live stream. And then you can statically set up the keys, or you can use some ICE daemon, which is IPKMPD, which we actually use for the setups. You have two modes, transport and tunnel mode. Well, we mainly use tunnel mode, but we'll have one specific setup where we actually use transport mode to reduce the number of security associations we have for the IPsec tunnels, which will already hopefully see interactively on the stage. Well, what's the big advantages in terms for us for IPsec? It's implemented in kernel, so you don't have a lot of copying going on between kernel and user land. It's layer 3 protocol, so basically tunneling over it is quite good. If you tunnel TCP over that IP, it's all right. TCP over TCP, which we'll later see, is quite a pain. So you have to find out other ways to kind of deal with that part. And you can build up really nicely if it actually works. So it will soon hopefully work. You can build up high available IPsec gateways. You have a SA-Strength daemon, which sends the security association between the machines. It's a little bit like PFSync, just for the security associations and the kernel, but it's not really productive use yet, so hopefully with 4.0 there'll probably be a hackathon in Germany for IPsec where they can work on that. We'll see, but that'll be definitely huge improvement. You have high available IPsec gateways. Well, it's standardized, but theoretically easy to hook up between vendors, but we're facing big problems when talking to different vendors like this for CheckOne. It's possible, but it's always really specialized configuration, and so on that part, well, kind of a, well, it's not an advantage, really. You look at it like that. What's the disadvantages, really? Well, it's fairly complex to set up and debug. It's getting easier and easier. There's a new tool like IPsec Control, which abstracts the whole complexity of the setup, where you can really fairly easily. There's a tutorial setting IPsec up in 4 minutes or something. If you just look 4 minutes IPsec, OpenBSD, you'll find it. So a standard way to configure it is now getting fairly easy with that new layer of abstraction. But it used to be fairly complex, and both for dynamic ISOC and PD constant, especially for setting up with different vendors, it's definitely a pain. And it's quite hard to debug. I mean, once you, well, SAs, they sort of time out, they, like, phase one doesn't break, there's nothing all of a sudden involved, there's hot discovery, and whatever going on, it's just by the last few years of debugging that kind of stuff, you totally go crazy when you debug ISOC and PD, and you just digging around, kind of pain, you'll feel a little bit lost once it gets really hardcore and down level. You had lots of problems with Kotlin 2 discovery that we fixed finally, but on that term, it's quite hard to debug. Well, it's what we also saw the firewall, so there's application level gateways going on, and quite hard to bring it to IPsec with an application level gateway on proxy in IPsec, right? Because, well, it's not really possible. Well, the conflicting networks part you'll probably see on the example, because if your company, the big company, buys another company, they're using the same network, but they're not 100% bought, they're just 50, or they cannot tell the admins there, you change your network, all of a sudden you have clashing networks, but still you have to somehow set up a secure channel between the networks. Then you have to all of a sudden start dealing with nothing, VNUT and redirects, and it gets all nasty and even more complex as it already is. On the other terms, using it as a stage, we'll see later, you have local sockets, and that's much easier to combine networks that actually clash, but then over SSH don't. Well, let's go into our first set. Is there any questions till now? Or, all right. Standard setup, what we have in, this is kind of superior. Feels funny. Antique. Well, all right, this is what we're usually having. We haven't, like, the standard way build up is usually PAP, so like a packet filter, application level, that packet filter. But I'll just skip the packet filter on the outside. So we have an application level gateway packet filter as a central firewall unit. From there, there's a DMZ interface where you actually terminate all the secure traffic or all the incoming traffic. You might have your web service here or some other farms or whatever. Or it will be used as a balance to come into it in some internal LAN, but you actually want to terminate your encrypted traffic in the DMZ. So what we have here is like two open BSD boxes. They're always in the couple. Well, this is the centralized. Usually we'll have really centralized, in the DMZ, you'll have centralized units running cart, having a high available part of it. As I said before, it's not really totally high available without the async yet, but it's getting there, and we'll have some way where it's short outage, but still works fine. We'll talk about that. And, okay, well, the normal setup would be, all right, company buys other company. You have to figure out, all right, set up a channel between the two. And standard routing, pretty easy to set up, 4 minutes, as said in the manual. If you have a ISOC and PD working with it, it's still quite standard and easy to set up. But that's actually most never the case that you can just bump in and, all right, because usually they probably, or they have like some this is the network from the customer. So you have a router here. This is not there yet, so this is what you're going to bring in. And all right, they don't really want to change anything in their infrastructure. So all you actually can do, you can say, all right, we go clear text, which you never want to do because there's some important data going on. And all right, you can not even take the whole network traffic out of there. You just have to slightly go over, say, okay, for whatever CAD network, we slightly want to enable IPsec right there. The rest just has to be bridged through. So you bring in this OpenBSD box using the bridge. Can also use CART, which is, we're not totally integrated with the bridge yet, but that work is going on too. So CARP is, or bridge is not aware of CARP. No, CARP is not aware of the bridge right now, but you can use, there's a thing called if-state daemon, which is a daemon actually reacting on the state of the interface and giving event to the usual end, and you can actually launch any application you want. So once you're, once you're, much better. So once your one host goes down, interface daemon, if state daemon realizes, oops, it's down, makes a failover to the other machine, and there you can fire up the ITAK and P daemon and establish VSAs. So your outage will be like half a minute at most, 1 minute. So combined with the if state daemon, you have a pretty powerful way to do high available IPsec bridging right there. So what you do is, well, there's two ways you can bridge actually the IPsec traffic. Let's see. Alright, there's already the errors in there. Alright, well, if you want a complete LAN to LAN bridging, you want to catch this whole traffic right there, totally bridge it right here, go to the target host, target network. That's fairly easy. You just set up a GIF interface here. It's a IP and IP encapsulating interface. You use that, you set up the GIF interface and an address in here. And you use the GIF interface in the bridge, you set up a bridge, add it to the bridge, and just bridge right into there so you get encapsulated. You set up the security associations only between these two addresses, so all you need is two security associations, one in each direction, right? So you bridge right into there, the whole traffic goes into there, gets bridged over there, but that's actually what you, well, sometimes you need that, but almost never we use it. What we use is there's a flag to the bridge. You can say it's called a link-to flag. You just set up a bridge and you say, okay, link-to flag, and it actually, what it tells the bridge is to pass all the traffic it sees into the IPsec stack and check and use encryption if it's set up. So you actually have to set up, well, it depends how many security associations, how many network you're actually configuring, but with that flag you can say, okay, most of my traffic just get bridged through, but I have security associations for this in this network, and it gets right bridged into there and encrypted over there. So you can slightly, it's called bumping the wire. It's nothing new or anything, but it's very useful when you slightly want to switch over and encrypt some of your traffic you're having. So this scenario, so the transparent bridging part is actually very, very useful when it comes to in terms of that you bought another company or you have to figure out, you can bridge the whole LAN, you can secure just one host, you can, the granularity is just up to you. The security associations can be very fine-grained. You can say, okay, I if it supports IPsec, I do IPsec. You can act on this machine as being this machine and start securing the traffic. So there's a whole lot of possibilities and very highly integrated into OpenBSD, and it's been there, I think, since 2001, so it's very, very useful and powerful way to combine networks. But, well, as I said before, what the big problem is too, if you have a 10.1.1, 10/8 network here and 10/8 network here, and you can't really bridge because there's clashing address spaces and everything, then you start nodding on this interface, and that's the point where it's getting nasty, because then you get, for debugging, and it's possible we do it, okay, sometimes you just do nasty things because you have to do it. But this is really the time where the well, if you have applications, there's a whole bunch of applications that you cannot really tunnel over SSH the way you're tunneling them. So you really need layer 3 tunneling over IPsec, thinking of FTP or other very esoteric stuff you see there. But this is really when you have when those two when those two locations have to be set up all the time, you have a static link there, you always want this traffic going this way, and then it's a very flexible and nice way to set it up, getting easier and easier. So now we're getting to the next level. We say, okay, all our security traffic terminates in the BMZ, but we have to bring in this traffic all the way into our internal network, somewhere attached to the packet filter, and we have some CAD application which really has to be based on the addresses it sees up here, so you have to bring all those addresses all the way down there. And the possibilities you have there, okay, you bridge the IPsec in here, and then there's a nice way, okay, you route them into GIF again, pack them up, route them all the way down, pack them out, and go in here. So that stuff we do too, that makes the whole traffic. You can have your intrusion detection system here looking deep, inspecting your packet, or the application layer gateway deep inspecting your packet, which we're actually not doing right now, but you could actually look into the packet. You have the encryption, encrypt the channel ending here and carried it all the way in there, which is also something which is quite nasty, but if you really need those addresses seen down there, that's the way to do it, and that's how you actually do it. Well, yeah, that's about, well, any questions on the IPsec part, on the bridging, flexible card? Well, really, the nice thing is, once you set up the card, the high available card, the bridge, it's really customized config, so you can deploy that stuff fairly easy to all your locations. Once you got it once figured out, you can have other stuff running it and setting it up, because it's just a few places where you change your configuration. So, yeah.
You have a real world difference between the tunnels and IPsec in this, for example.
Yeah.
Some thing.
Is that the second to do a lot better over, say, really high packet loss?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because that's something we've been just recently debugging. It is going to do a lot better than SSH, because what we have later, if you use SSH here, you have a TCP connection here, and you actually, what we do, you tunnel a whole load of other, well, what we had, for example, we had a location somewhere in Asia, and what we're doing all the time is, big companies want to centralize all their stuff, so they have one huge Squid farm, or one huge Citrix farm, Node farm, whatever, centralized in Munich or somewhere in Germany. So you're carrying all that way from Asia, all the nodes and web traffic going into here, and tunneling over one SSH connection. And TCP is fairly sticky when it gets some packet loss, it drops and then tries to recover and drops back again. And all those inner tunnels. Your tunnel applications, like the node, it just breaks down the whole thing. With the IPsec, it just affects one tunnel in the tunnel, right? Because there you're not having there on the IP traffic, it's not going to drop the whole speed of the line. So you have end to end TCP, which is actually better in that term, of course. Yeah. So that's a real big problem we're facing too. We're like tunneling a lot of connections over one SSH. We'll probably just split it up and over a lot of tunnels SSH times, not pouring down the whole thing. All right, let's see what you get there. Well, OpenSSH—that's obviously what we're using. Yeah, bunch of advantages. It's widely used and accepted. It's very nicely developed. It's fairly separated. It's all over the place, standardized, and there it's practically easy to hook up with other vendors. We will see that in terms when you have QWERTY on Windows or other SSH implementations you have to talk to, you have to set up your connections. It's easy to proxy, it has own proxying support. It supports its local sockets, we'll see that in forwardings and SOCKs, it supports SOCKs protocol forwarding. So you can have remote socket tunneled over SSH. Well, and it's fairly easy to just set up in shell scripts or whatever. You can dynamically set up SSH tunnels or having own daemons just multiplexing all over the place. The disadvantages, well, just recently there's been support for, you can totally bridge over an SSH tunnel. That's how it works. You set up a phone device which is attached to your SSH daemon or and client side, and you just bridge like you bridged before in the GIF interface. You bridge into there and bridge the whole network on the other side. So right now with the biggest disadvantage, people say you cannot have UDP over SSH. So now it's possible to also have UDP over SSH or whole layer 2 bridging. But the big disadvantage is really on that terms, when you just bridge into there, it's when you tunnel TCP over TCP, that just totally freaks out all the time, and you run into crazy timing problems, and you really don't want to do it. The nice way to do it is, well, to split up in many hops, so you have like not only one TCP connection, but you split up the TCP connections in many. So you just lose end-to-end TCP, but still you figure out you're not having these timing issues running TCP and TCP. And the big disadvantage is, we're not yet having problems with the speed, but it's implemented in Uselink, so you can have quite a lot of copying between currently Uselink going on. All right, well, again, now this will be a setup where what we're using for, or what you could use, actually not productively using yet, but as an idea, we have an SSH gateway, right? This solution has a big, big disadvantage that you actually need some special features in OpenSSH, which I don't know if they're already implemented in other SSH versions. I think in PuTTY it's not implemented yet. But what we're having let's say I'm out in New York. I want to log into our network at work and just do some administration on some machines. You'll have an SSH gateway sitting here in the VM set, which can, actually I'll show that on the board, but, which can, that I log in into here, and on my SSH key there's a command restriction which says, all right, when you do comes with this key, it's you fork this command and act on this, in this command you can actually build up a whole new way of command. And for example, just say, okay, we'll probably need some light here.
No light for you.
No light for you.
Well, you have a command restriction. As I say, the easiest way you can think of is, you say cmd initial. Alright, so I come in, this command is found to my key. There's a whole ass load of stuff you can found to a key, so that's really interesting to look into that. If you want to see what the possibilities are, there's a nice paper by Damien Miller too where you can play with SSH. So what you do, you have a command found to the key, a whole bunch of restrictions, no forwarding allowed, that and then that. But this is really the fun part. So here you fork, for example, a shell script. So as follow one in your shell script, you get the username. So then you have some authentication you want to do. For example, do it against Delta. That's what we've been doing. Or some other whatever comment. So you verify the user. User's all right. Then you get out of the database or whatever place you're looking at. You get you can look up what is this user allowed to do. Well, okay, he's an administrator for this and this and this network. Let's say he can jump from here to here in the admin net, which is only allowed for a few people, or you can just easily make it even host space. He can only jump on this host and that host. So, all right, we can, you now see, you get the user with a, there's a variable where you can get the whole command. It's a SSH original command. So there you can also see the user logging in from C out there, he says, okay, I want to go here, right? This dude out there said SSH to this machine, SSH port. But he sets up his SSH client the way that it actually says, okay, I'm going to connect. It's an extension proxy command. You can say, if I want to connect to here, you go over this one. So what he actually says is SSHC, but with a proxy command to go here. And here you can read out the proxy command where he actually wanted to go. So you figure out, okay, the user's authenticated. He wanted to go here. And then based on that information you got out of the database, you figure out, all right, is this user allowed to go there? You say, then there you can do all the logging easily. You can say, okay, dude's coming in, wants to go there, is allowed, time. And you can not doing it in a shell script, actually doing it in a own daemon, having a little daemon that does all the stuff here. You can do all kinds of timing stuff. You can, let's finish this. You can, okay, here you got the user ready, you got the host authentic, you said, okay, user and host, they fit. So now you're having a netcat saying, all right, your netcat goes to the final destination, which would be down there, admin net C, AC, and the port. So, but this command is totally dynamic. You can build up any command you want. What it does is builds up a TCP connection over here, and the original SSH will go all the way end-to-end secure down to this goal. So, okay, this proxy command we're using on the client side, I'm not sure if any other implementation has yet. But it's very useful because, okay, on the client side, you say proxy command equals SSH gateway. So if you say, this dude really says all he has to do is say in this SSH config, okay, every time you want to go to work, this and that, you say SSH gateway, go over this gateway, multiplex it. This one multiplexes all the way in there. The same stuff we do to go for admins outside. You say, all right, these admins are allowed to do all kinds of stuff out there. And the whole dynamic is really good. The whole fun part is right there with the command. You have a daemon there that does all timings. You say, okay, do it only 5 minutes. He can connect to it. Then you close the socket. He can only finish this connection. So you have a very, very nice way to dynamically build up a whole system from SSH multiplexing. And not even SSH, you can do, you can multiplex lots of TCP connections over that. That's a fairly flexible way to use the SSH. What you need is the proxy command on the client side. And then on the gateway side, you just have to build up your own shell script. There's a nice paper and you can even, the gateways can be staffed, so, all right, there's a nice paper on that part, how you can do it with a shell script, but actually doing it with an own daemon is much more useful, since Netcat sometimes hangs open connections. Oh, no, that's not it. And another nice way you can actually do this is, what I said before, you have a big company, they're having a whole bunch of machines in their local network. For example, they bought from whatever printing machine from. Okay, here's the firewall part. The same as the firewall. There's the LAN. And what we used to see is you have like all kinds of devices sitting there, which have to be administratively accessible from the outside. So, for example, one nice candidate is SAP. They really don't want to send you any SAP consultants right there. It's quite expensive when they send them to you. They want to have remote login, and they even, or HP, for example, they're very picky on not sending you people there. They want to have remote access if you want help from them. So that's part of their whole policy, telling you the stuff. So let's say we have HP here, SAP here, whoever, some huge printing manufacturer, made it. And what you have is them sitting out there, let's say SAP, and now you have the night task to somehow securely bring this person into your internal network, which we do like this. It's called rendezvous. It's called the fairly old technique, actually. You make up a meeting point in the DMZ. So you have an OpenBSD box sitting here. You bring in, well then, now again, that can be very nicely integrated with the bridge. You say, all right, I have this already set up. It's been used in various ways, but never really had the support. But now we need the support, or they're not sending the people in anymore. So you can either have a bridge sitting in here, securing these, or have a normal OpenBSD box securing these. Okay, so what we do is, we have one management station sitting right here. Management station. So, okay, the people here from this group say that there's some responsible people that have actually access to the management station. And, okay, here you provide some kind of web interface or whatever you feel like, whatever your infrastructure already has, which doesn't make a lot of trouble, where you can authenticate the user that he's allowed to bring in the SAP person into the internal network to figure out some problem here. If it doesn't have to be constantly, this is totally on demand, because you don't want them in there all the time, you just want them in there whenever there's a problem, right? So, alright, what we do is, from here, whole logic is implemented. Well, not whole logic, but some pick up the logic is implemented here. What you do here by the validation, you have some logic, say, okay, open the tunnel port for SAP. Okay, and what the CGI does, in our terms, it makes the connection here, telling this one, we want SAP to support our machine. Please set up a tunnel so they can come in. This machine then loads a different packet filter set on terms of the secure. Well, there's already quite strict securing on this machine going on, but could be during regular hours. This machine has some connection to some database server here or whatever. But during support, you really want only the dude should not be able to come anywhere in your internal network. So you have a packet filter set. You load a specific packet filter set that is really nicely done with anchors. You can have very nice integration over anchors. Anchors support a way you can say an anchor. What is an anchor? An anchor in the packet filter set is a place where you can include packet filter rules. So you can just inject new packet filter rules on the fly without any reload or anything. So you can say, okay, in terms when this is done, you just the only thing is allowed to connect here. And anchors has a nice extension. You can say, okay, yeah, you have a rendezvous general anchor /*, which means you can dynamically inject names, anchor names in there even. So you can really dynamically inject rules and figure out whole new rule set. So what you do is you load this new rule set. All these dudes never even, they are not in maintained state. They stay same way as before. This one gets restricted. You open up an SSH connection here with -r, opening a local port here, or a few local ports if you need. Usually they only need one port, SSH forward, or some cyclic, whatever, which is usually proxable. So you open a remote socket here. So what you open with this connection is one socket here. SAP gets well, there's two ways we do it. We send them the information, or they can get them by phone, where they send in their user key, which that's the machine. That's the key. Well, here's the remote port. They send SAP has to send in, all right, user X, which is responsible for us, has to send in his key, which is fairly easy because everybody uses SSH. You can tell him how to use PuTTY, it's pre-configured, which is all the big companies adapt to it. It's for in our terms. Only very few refuse to use SSH to come in. Okay, so this key is also here in authorized keys. And again, the key is totally restricted to only open locally open tunnels. So he comes in here with the minus L forwarding into this tunnel. So what he says is, all right, I come here, I want my port 22 forwarded to 1001, port 1015, which is this port. So what they locally forward their port from here, port 22, well, or actually locally port 22, over here and fall into this port and coming through this tunnel all the way down there. So those are totally locally bound, and on the key by the user, there's also actually a command restriction where you can say, okay, this tunnel has to stay open. Well, actually, they only get to sleep here. So what they get is here they get a command sleep SAP wants 1 hour, okay, you'll chill here for 1 hour, then the tunnel automatically gets closed, and if there's somebody connecting through it, he'll stay open, or you can forcibly say, okay, let's close it. So this is a very, very nice way to use SSH to, in a rendezvous system, to bring in external, well, this you have all the time now. You have to bring in all kinds of different people from the outside. And once you have this set up, you have here the bridge, which is very flexible. And it's fairly, very easy. You have authorized keys, some commands, a little logic here, and understand that those users say most of the time use PuTTY, or if it's a bigger company, maybe SSH. Open SSH, and their clients are fairly easy to configure. So this way you can really nicely set up whole remote administration of your system. Well, there's one up. Yep.
According to the network, what are the weak points?
What?
Looking at this network, what are the weakest points?
What are the weakest points?
Yeah.
Well, one of the big problems one of the big problems is that all of a sudden this key, which was formerly bound to one employee from SAP, is all over SAP, and all kinds of people are using this key to get into the network, which is kind of a pain because you only want actually one person from here. Copying the key is quite fairly easy, and once you have the private key, they just copy it along and give it to some employees next to them or some friend or whatever. All right, here you go. But that's not something we want. We don't want our key all over SAP, all kinds of people in there. So what we do on the second stage is either have a CryptoCard authentication. If we want it extensive, we have to send up. Or the other way is we have a telephone support where they have to call in and verify to a special phrase, but also this one can be passed along, so that's quite easy actually. If you don't want it expensive with Aladdin or CryptoCard or whatever, which, because if it's hardware, they're not going to give it along. Hardware is kind of there picky about space with them, but virtual key can just be copied wherever. That's quite a big problem. Well, it's a problem, for sure. Another problem is that you have really multiplex over a whole bunch of PCP connections here. You have like one here locally, having local hosting for it, having different entities, whatever, having another one. But other than that, it works quite well because those are just ad hoc secure connections because you're not having problems here all the time. And you're not going to use this for building up a whole network of connections that's sent up all the time. It's just for a short period of time, bringing the guy, you can, okay, grab some information from here, figure out, all right, is it a huge problem? Can I fix it like this? Or what can I do about it? Other than that, it's straightforward, actually. It's really right. It's, I think there's no bigger problem than if it's one at the same time. Anything that you use like this, that you want to have different, that you think sucks in this whole thing? Alright, so we'll come finally to the end, pretty much. You can have, with OpenBSD, you can have very, very incredibly flexible solutions to that, very various customer requirements. Well, what I wanted to do is actually have a live demonstration of the whole setting up, actually having a live demonstration of transparent IPsec, but the QEMU is constantly crashing my system, so wasn't really smart to update quite before the talk, but now it's just freezing the system, so we're not going to have the live demo. Probably going to put out the QEMU instances with it, where you can see how it works. Have to think about that. Well, anyway,
we can post it on the site here. Maybe.
What?
We can post it on the site for the URL.
Yeah, we can think about how we can have a nice transparent, not even, I wanted to bring in not how you can see totally transparent all of a sudden, bring in IPsec and not, and it just continues to work and tear down one QEMU instance, have high available ones, and the other one taking over. It's fairly straightforward, really. There's a bunch of files you have to kind of check out, and once you got that, it's very nicely integrated. So you have a very flexible ways you can deal with whatever your whole constraints and requirements are. You have it highly integrated. You have the PF, which is almost its own programming language as MIPI test. It's you have the bridge, which is very nicely integrated with IPsec. You have CART, which will be hopefully in the future working better together with bridge, being bridge aware. You have the if state daemon, which is aware of the interface state, which can call any process or any program you want in userland. And then you have SSH, which is its own world anyway. And once you got the whole system rolled out, well, we have fairly always centralized management, making up all those tuples, triples, whatever, in a centralized management really helps. So. But that doesn't need so much, actually. And once it's rolled out, it's fairly easy to maintain. And the nice part is, well, with the SSH, making it high available, if it's local socket, you always lose those local sockets, so you have to reinitiate the connections. But still, you have high available security gateways, high available security IPsec gateways in special, which is very nice. And the scalable part, there's something I forgot to talk about. All right, we'll go back to that. You have very scalable and secure systems, which have all the nice stuff included in the base system, nothing much you need to. I just want to go back to one, or no, I'll go going back. What we refer to as the SA crisis is, you have a initiating security initiation is phase one. It's quite some heavy stuff on your devices, especially on those outside networks. Well, we're back to IPsec again. Think about what we're using is circuit hardware for the small companies outside. We have to bring in or sort of small offices, whatever. And if you have a centralized system like we had before, you have here the high available IPsec gateways in the DMZ. You have Ethernet, Internet, and there you have the circuit hardware. And now you have all over the world. You have offices you wanna combine, and you wanna highly like a start. No, not like a start. Actually, you wanna. You want them all to talk to each other, right? So that will bring up a whole ad load of security associations for every network you're having behind that. It will just add up and multiply and be like, you have, let's say, 80 for the circuits, 80, like 50 is, I think 50 at the edge is the limit for this. Like, because we have a timeout for 20 minutes for the security association, and it takes longer to establish all the security associations before old ones time out. So then you completely freaks out and you have random faults, not having a security association right there. So what you can do is, and what's actually really nice, when we first thought of, you can, as I said before, we're using, we can go through tunnel mode, using the gateway. So tunnel mode, what it does is puts an extra IP header in front of it, and the whole old packet is in here. Transport mode just puts the ESP header here. You need two security associations in transport mode for the two sides. So what you can do, you can use either, for example, you can use the GIF interface to encapsulate your packet and then do transport mode on the gateway. So what you do is you're not going to do a whole, all those networks, let's say you have three networks here and you have another one, three here, so you already need 3x3, for every combination you need two SAs, so you need 18 SAs. So what you do is you encapsulate all this network traffic into a new IP packet and then just do transport mode. So you have only two security associations between this and this network, and you, on the way out, you just unroll that IP and IP traffic again. And the bridge even has it, you not have to use the GIF interface, the IPsec already has an IP and IP encapsulation which you can use for that. So what you do, you set up IP and IP encapsulation and then only have two SAs for each site and totally got rid of the whole SA mess you had before. And that totally scales very well for us. Alright, I guess that means we're gonna have a little party. Is there any questions? Yep.
Go back to the screen where you have a netcat.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm not too sure how, like, you may have seen, like, you update from the top feed, the top client to the space gateway.
Yep.
And then, somehow netcat copies it all over to the destination host or something.
Well, it's actually two connections. And SSH has this extension that is called proxy command. So you can say SSH, okay, usually you would say SSH to this machine.
Yeah.
So now you can tell SSH, instead of connecting to this machine, you do first connect to this machine, and through this you connect all the way, you get a virtual channel to the other machine. So what you actually do is you first SSH into this by the proxy command. So that would make your proxy command in this term be proxy command equals SSH gateway, right? So what it first would do is it SSH to the gateway. The gateway does all the authentication, and then on itself does the netcat. And through this whole channel, you get the connection to the end host, and it's then going to be encrypted. So your outside SSH doesn't even know this.
You're using SSH as the proxy command.
Yeah, exactly. You're actually using, yeah.
Where is that actually configured?
When you set up hosts, you can just, for each host you set, or you can do it for the star. When, for example, from the inside to go to the outside, you simply can say host star for every host you use the proxy command I want to connect to. Or you can configure it on host space, or the whole, you can also give it on the command line, minus O, big O, and then just say proxy command equals blah blah blah. But actually, the nice part is what you really have to do in this term. You have to give the users the configuration. They're not going to do it themselves. Even if they're able to, they're just way too lazy to do it. But it's no problem. You just give them the SSH config, and they just works right there. That is actually doing all the distribution of the keys, setting up these highly configurable own database systems where you can dump into the keys and then have groups, administrative groups, and it does the whole work for you. So that tool is very, without that tool, it would just be half the solution.
Yeah, anyway.
What?
The main page in
I don't know if it should be on Fresh Meat.
What's
DMZ?
I haven't gotten that yet. What's that?
What?
A DMZ?
It's thin mail interrupt zone.
D.
Alright.
What's the name of that thing?
Is it Gneischwagen? I don't know what that is. I'll just figure out if they finally put it on Freshmeat or what they're doing. Not sure. But it's you're right. That part has to be there.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Are there any other questions?
Perfect.
Okay, there's just one more quick announcement. We collected, Ocon's right now counting, but we're going to pass this around one more time for anybody who didn't manage to get to it. But again, we're collecting money for the OpenBSD Hackathon. These funds are going with Ray, and don't worry, we're going to count them before we give it to Ray.
Oh.
But anyway, we're going to pass it around one more time for anyone else to donate. And also, again, if you want to get a t-shirt, the first t-shirt is $7. Anything after, you get multiple t-shirts to $6 a piece. So again, we're trying to collect money for the hackathon. And again, thank you enormously to Mickey and to Misha.
And actually,
we collected $272. And if anybody wants to put IOUs in here, that's very good actually for this, all right? You know, is anybody like CIO of Morgan Stanley in here? But anyway, so if anybody wants to donate again, you want to throw IOUs in here because you don't have your checkbook with you, anything like that, let us know. And obviously, like, everybody knows they're getting it, like, whatever they want, they can throw it. So anyway, should pass this around if people just want to, like, anyway, anybody who wants t-shirts, come up. Talk to Ocon, he'll deal with that.
Oh,
no. Alright. And now it's time to drink.
I'm not sure you need to change.
What? If you want to smoke quick, you can go right out here.
Right.
But make sure you pay your damn.
Are you good enough?
Sorry.
I'm going to.
Ah, yes.